We need to talk about guys who weren't exactly Christian, but their ideas, their thoughts had a big influence, a big impact on the way the church began to think. And so we have people like Immanuel Kant, Hegel, Kierkegaard, David Hume, and Friedrich Nietzsche, just a few that we'll touch on. Immanuel Kant, he wrote about pure reason, some of the problems about trying to prove things with pure reason, and he was very skeptical about doing it. And then he wrote a work, a critique of practical reason, where he argued that when we use practical reason, it's not so much that we can know things with certainty, but we're safer to assume certain things are true once we bring practical reason into the picture. Whatever the case, Immanuel Kant said that we can know reality as it appears to us, that's the phenomena, but we can't know reality as it is, the noumena. He talked about we'll get back to that, but he talked about transcendental categories are necessary for human knowledge. These are similar to the Platonic ideas, that there are certain categories of the mind, like you know, space and time and causality. But human reason, in order to function, accepts certain transcendental illusions as true, though they cannot be proven by reason. And the example uses is causality. We look at one thing happening, and then, you know, A, whenever A happens, we see B following it time and time again, so we assume, well, then A caused B. But what Immanuel Kant is arguing is that there's no real reason to believe in causality. All we've got is just that B follows A, and the whole causality thing is something we assume. We haven't proven it. So he saw that as a problem to human reason. The way I would state this type of problem for the ultra-rationalist like David Hume, trying to prove everything through reason alone. And by the way, all of this is a response to Rene Descartes trying to prove everything through reason alone. All of this is a response to Rene Descartes trying to prove everything through reason alone. The beginning of the Enlightenment, start of modernistic thinking, that we could find all truth and solve all problems through reason alone. Well, it wasn't long before guys like Immanuel Kant came on the scene and realized that all-powerful reason isn't all-powerful after all. The way I would put it is that even if we could find lots of truths through reason, we can't prove everything through reason, because then we would have to prove our starting points through reason, and then our starting points wouldn't be our starting points. The premises that led up to them would be, but then we'd have to prove them through reason. So you got to start somewhere. I think Gordon Clark was onto something. He's what I call a dogmatic presuppositionalist, the late Gordon Clark, at least he was in his earlier years. He argued that reason works, but you have to dogmatically presuppose something, your starting points. And so now he dogmatically presupposed the existence of the triune God as revealed in Scripture and the law of non-contradiction. I think that, you know, there's other things we could presuppose still to arrive at the truth. But whatever the case, he realized that you've got to assume something. Just pure reason alone, there's a problem. That's what Kant is doing. Kant is using his reason as he writes, but he's saying pure reason, there's a problem with pure reason. If you just use nothing but reason, you can't prove all things through reason alone. He talked about antinomies or contradictions exist that cannot be reconciled through human reason. Here I think he was at his weakest, because he talked about things as if there was no way to reconcile certain things, that, you know, like if everything needs a cause, then God needs a cause. Well, we don't have to argue everything needs a cause. We have to argue everything that has a beginning needs a cause. God doesn't have a beginning, so God doesn't need a cause. But some of these so-called contradictions, I don't even think really were contradictions. I think they could be reconciled through human reason. But he's making a point, and so he's going out of his way to get as much evidence as he can for it. And so he argued that we could not prove God through pure reason. And so he attacks all the traditional arguments for God's existence. So these philosophers were attacking traditional apologetics, the arguments that had won the day for 1,500 years or so in the history of Western thought, all of a sudden these guys are saying those arguments don't work. Now, having said that, he argued that's pure reason, but through practical reason, still we must assume God's existence and life after death if we are to make sense of our sense of morality. So through practical reason, he actually developed his own moral argument for God's existence. So when the atheist likes to turn to Immanuel Kant and say, now there's a guy who's defending my view, no. No. In fact, if it wasn't for so much emphasis on trying to prove everything with logical necessity, it's possible that Kant might not have been so hard on the traditional arguments. But at this point, when we read the traditional arguments for God's existence through the lenses of Descartes, everybody thinks that the traditional apologists were trying to prove everything with logical necessity. And I don't think that's the case. He uses practical reason and builds a moral argument for God's existence. If you had a list of 100 of the greatest philosophers in the history of Western civilization, you'd be lucky if you can have anybody come up with a list of 100, and if they were really fair about it, to come up with more than 10 atheists. In fact, I'm not even sure there'd be that many would show up on that list. But the key thing, though, Immanuel Kant's getting at is that, look, we can know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is. I'd be like this Bible in my hand. Now, I'm going to really simplify Kant's thought here, so I'm not going to do him total justice, but this is kind of what he's getting at. There's a Bible in my hand. Well, how do I know it's here? Well, because I have an idea of the Bible in my head. Okay? So it's like I take a snapshot, a photograph of the Bible, and have that photograph in my head. So then Kant says, well, how do you know it's accurate? That's easy. I take my idea of the Bible, the photograph, and I compare it to the Bible, and they both look alike. Problem is, I don't have the Bible. I'm comparing the photograph of the Bible to another one of my ideas of the Bible, another photograph. And we never have any way of getting past the ideas. Now, I think that in Gordon Clark, the earlier Gordon Clark, before he turned to a radical view, which I would call scripturalism, the earlier Gordon Clark, I think, had a good response to that. And that is that if we just except that a rational God created us in his image so that we're rational beings and created the universe in a way that makes sense and in a way that it was knowable to us, then through reason we really can know about the universe in which we live. In other words, as Christians, I don't think we have to come up with the how of epistemology. Epistemology is our theory of knowledge. I don't think we have to explain how we know, because we know the who. In God's light we see light, says the psalmist. St. Augustine quoted from him to promote his view of epistemology of knowledge, his theory called illumination. God turns the light on and we know. We don't know how we know, but we know that we know, because we know that God is not deceiving us. You know, we might misinterpret sense perception, but that's our fault. But God, the sense perception is basically reliable because God wanted us to find out truth about the world in which we live. So once you acknowledge the existence of a rational God, I don't think you have to go as far as Gordon Clark, the triune God of the Bible who reveals himself in the scriptures. I think the law of non-contradiction, we do have to presuppose the laws of logic just to think. I think once you have that presupposition, this dilemma goes away. Now, if you want to reject the who, i.e. God, who created us in his image, who created the universe in a way that makes sense so we can find out about the world in which we live, you want to reject the who, then you better come up with the how. Well, how do you know that? How do we know what we know? And atheists reject the who of knowledge, the all-knowing God, yet they still can't explain the how. Even Michael Martin, in the beginning of his book, Atheism, a Philosophical Justification, Dr. Michael Martin from Boston University, he just whitewashes over coming up with a good, solid atheistic epistemology. He says that modern philosophers don't agree anyway, so this is something we could just pass over. But wait a minute. What he's saying is modern philosophers know, but there's no undisputed champ about what, you know, how man knows. problem. So you don't just gloss over it. You say, well, why didn't the Christians have this problem? Knowledge was pretty much a given with them. And it's the same with creation. Since we know the who, we don't have to explain the how. The evolutionist says, well, we know, we figured out the how so we can reject the who. Okay, well, how did we get here? Evolution. Well, how did evolution, whatever that means, how did evolution occur? Well, maybe mutations, nobody knows. We all disagree on the how, but we know it occurred. So you don't really know the how. But whatever the case, so Immanuel Kant, we can know realities appear to us, but not reality as it is. Then Hegel comes on the scene. Now, you would think Hegel, after Kant, just knocked René Descartes out cold. His theory of knowledge is just shot. You'd think Hegel would say, okay, well, I got to pick up where Kant left off. But no. He tries to argue Descartes was right, Kant was wrong, and he becomes another one of these ultra-rationalists, but then his whole view of truth is way out there. But Hegel's response to Kant was the statement, we can know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is. Is that a statement about reality as it is? Because if it's not, you just wasted my time. You're just saying, well, it appears that things are this way, but who knows? Well, whatever. Just have another beer and go somewhere else. Leave me alone. But if Kant says, no, this is a statement about reality as it is, then he's claiming to know reality as it is. See, Immanuel Kant is saying man cannot know truth. He can't know truth as it is. But that's a claim to know truth as it is. Okay? So Kant's whole skeptical project really failed, and Hegel understood that. At the same time, Hegel did not like absolute truth himself, so he argued that absolute truth is something that unfolds through history. That throughout history, he had a dialectical view of history. Marx and then now Hegel was an idealist. Only ideas are real. Okay? So like the whole physical realm and stuff like that, Hegel's like, no, ideas are the real thing. Okay? And so he's an idealist. Marx, who was a materialist, borrowed a simplified form of Hegel's thought and came up with dialectical materialism. So with Marx, you still have the thesis and the antithesis, two opposing views that get synthesized, and eventually the final stage in the synthesis will be the classless society. Hegel comes right out in one of his works in the preface and lambasts the idea that his dialectical view of history is that absolute truth is constantly in a state of flux and is being synthesized from different ideas. So people said, oh, so what he's saying is there's a thesis, some idea reigns, like maybe it's a limited government in America, okay? And then people oppose it with like an idea like socialism, all-powerful government, and they battle it out. Rather than one being true and the other being false, they get synthesized to form a new idea, big, powerful, good, benevolent government, which is what we have right now, is a synthesis of our founding fathers' thought and Soviet-style socialism, and what's being synthesized is a monster. It's just as deadly. It has the potential for the same slaughter that Joseph Stalin's socialism had. But whatever the case, people tried to pin Hegel down, and they said that Hegel was teaching there's a thesis, a triad, a thesis, an antithesis, and then they get synthesized. Rather than one being true and the other being false, they get synthesized to produce a new truth. In Hegel's thought, really, there could be, three theses and 10 antitheses, and they all just kind of just get all rolled up. It's not that simple. We really have to be careful when we look at the history of philosophy. You can see somewhat of a triad, like the ancient Greek philosophers who argued everything is being. And then the other Greek philosophers said, like Heracles, no, everything is change, everything is becoming. And then out of that was synthesized the philosophers, the idea that true reality is both being and becoming. That which remains the same, but that which also changes. The whole idea of the universe came out of that debate, the unity and diversity, okay? A sameness and a diversity. At the same time, we have to be careful when we look at history like that. We're probably oversimplifying the issue. Not everybody agreed with the thesis. Not everybody agreed with the antithesis. And the synthesis isn't usually a total synthesis of just those two ideas. Hegel led to the idea that what's true today might be true for today, but over time, that truth may get synthesized with its exact opposite. You know, if A is true, then traditional philosophy would say non-A, by definition, contradicts it, therefore it must be false. Whereas Hegel is saying A and non-A can be synthesized so that 30 years from now, maybe A, which was true, you know, 30 years ago, is no longer true. And so what you have here is one guy, Immanuel Kant, is attacking man's ability to know, and he's attacking the traditional arguments for God. Hegel, on the other hand, is bringing back Heraclitus and this changing God. He's actually deifying history, and you have a rejection of the physical creation, you have a rejection of absolute truth. So basically all the accomplishments of Western philosophical thought through Christian thought, all those accomplishments are being thrown up for grabs now. And so then there comes Søren Kierkegaard. He's called the father of modern existentialism. Existentialism is the idea that subjective beliefs are more important than objective truth. So for Kierkegaard, what's more important is that you believe with passion that Jesus rose from the dead. That's more important than the issue of whether Jesus rose from the dead or not. Now you read 1 Corinthians 15, verse 14, verse 17, the Apostle Paul totally disagrees with Søren Kierkegaard. So who am I going to side with? Okay, Kierkegaard, one of the greatest philosophers in history, granted. But he's just like a total non-entity next to the Apostle Paul, as far as I'm concerned, especially since I believe God inspired Paul to write what he wrote. But 1 Corinthians 15, 14, Paul says that if Christ has not been raised from the dead, your faith is useless, you are still in your sins. If Christ has not been raised from the dead, our preaching is vain. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, it doesn't matter how much you believe that he did. The truth remains the truth, no matter how much you believe it or how much you reject it. But see, with Kierkegaard, there's two things going on in his day. One is you've got all these philosophical, rational attacks against Christianity. And Kierkegaard had a very passionate religious life. Some Christian philosophers would call him a Christian. I tend to disagree. I don't think his views are really traditional Christian views. But whatever the case, he had a passionate religious life, and he's getting all these, the Bible is getting all these attacks from philosophers. And so what his strategy was, it's like, you guys are using reason to attack God's word. You're using reason to attack religion. Don't you understand? Religion isn't even in the same realm as reason. There's a total separation of reason and religion. See, now he's trying to protect Christianity through that. He's actually doing more damage than he's doing good. Okay? The problem was he had too much faith in what these philosophers were saying. He should have just met them head on instead of trying an elusive tactic. So it's like Francis Schaeffer talked about Kierkegaard, and modern religious thought follows in along those lines, where reason is in one story and faith is in another story, revelation from God in another story, and the two never meet. So our religious decisions are based solely, faith, instead of being putting our faith in what the evidence tells us is true, instead faith gets redefined as believing against the, apart from the evidence or against the evidence, believing the irrational. Talk to the average Christian today, and talk to the average person who isn't a Christian, who thinks he knows what Christianity is about. And I will tell you, I would be surprised that more than 15% of Americans understand that true biblical faith means trust. And the Lord asks us to trust in Him, but He gives us evidence to trust in Him. Jesus gave evidence to the apostles by leaving the tomb empty and then appearing to the apostles over a period of 40 days. So He said, just trust me. Based on what evidence? Come over here, touch the holes of my hands and my feet. Give me a piece of fish. Okay? And He ate it in their presence. So traditional faith is trusting in God because He has given us evidence to believe in Him and to trust in Him to keep His promises. Whatever the case, Soren Kierkegaard moves us away from that. The second reason why he used this tactic, this strategy, was the church of his day, Christianity of his day, was nothing but a creed. Nothing but propositional truth. People read a creed on Sunday and then they got drunk all week and beat their wives or whatever. And they were still considered good Christians because they believed the creed with head knowledge. So Christianity was reduced to propositional truth, period. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even obeying rules. If you reduce Christianity to nothing but rules and regulations, you still misunderstand Christianity. He's saying in his day in Europe, Christianity was nothing but propositional truth, and who cared about the rules and stuff? So to get away from that, Kierkegaard said, you have to passionately believe from the heart. See, Jesus said, God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth. John 4:24. Kierkegaard saying, you guys are trying to only worship in truth. You got to worship in spirit too. Okay? Now, here's the debate. He argued, truth doesn't matter. You just got to worship in spirit. It's just from the heart. Did he really mean that, or did he think, hey, the pendulum is so far over here, truth only, I want to get it to the middle, spirit and truth, so I'm going to argue for the will only and spirit only, and maybe I'll swing the pendulum to the middle. Now, the way you could make a case for that is when he wrote these books, he used a pseudonym. He didn't use his own name. At the same time, are we going to become mind readers? Let's decide, in all probability, what the guy believed was what he wrote. And probably the reason why he used the pseudonyms was for fear of getting, losing prestige, losing jobs, whatever, for bringing out radical views about Christianity. He argued subjective beliefs are more important than objective truth. He overemphasized the will, de-emphasized the intellect, and said that religious faith is a blind leap of faith into the non-rational realm. And so religious beliefs cannot be defended, they can only be believed. This is what's called fideism. It's anti-apologetics. You'll find this with Lessing. Gotthold Lessing's ugly ditch. Between the historical facts and religious beliefs, there's an ugly ditch that we can never pass. His ugly ditch, Kierkegaard's leap of blind faith, same thing pretty much. Now, let me give a little bit more of an explanation of Kierkegaard here. And the reason why I'm bringing up these guys is because of their impact on the church. Today, like I say, most people believe, most professing Christians think that their faith is a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm. And that if you give evidence for faith, it's no longer faith. Let me show you how they take passages. You know, Jesus said you got to have the faith of a child to come into God's kingdom. Well, let me tell you something. When your little child clings to you in a crowd, rather than saying, you know what, Daddy, I'm going to stop clinging to you and I'm going to start clinging to a total stranger. No. That's an intelligent faith. That's a trust saying, hey, Daddy knows. Daddy protects me. Daddy loves me. Daddy feeds me. These strangers don't. I don't know what their intentions are. I'm going to cling to Daddy. That's an intelligent faith. I remember one day I showed up at a firefighter's house, him and his wife, they were going to the same church we were going to, this was about 20-something years ago. I showed up and I was wearing blue jeans, I didn't look nothing like this guy, but I was wearing blue jeans, white sneakers, and a black and white plaid flannel shirt. he was wearing the exact flannel shirt, blue jeans, and white sneakers. And he had these two little twin girls. They're probably grown-up people now. But one of them just kept coming with her bottle. She was about 2 years old or something. And just kept grabbing me around the leg and just cuddling into my leg. And I'm talking with the guy, and I'm thinking, oh, man, this is weird. I don't know. You know, I don't want to yell at the kid and get the father mad. At the same time, this is kind of weird, you know. And he'd look at her and go, like this. And she'd be just like this. And she'd see him. Also, she'd see him and realize, if he's over there, you know, she used the law of non-contradiction. This is a rational face. She's using the law of non-contradiction. She said, if he's over there, that's not him over here. And she looks up at me, and she's like, she staggers back and stuff. And she did it about three or four times throughout the night. So it was like a real freaky thing. But she, you know, she was real little. She's looking up. Sometimes all she sees is the shirt and the pants and the sneakers, and she thinks this is daddy. And then when she finds out it's not, but that's an intelligent faith. Another passage they bring up, they like to bring up Hebrews chapter 11. It says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So they say, see, faith is blind faith, evidence of things not seen. No, read the whole chapter. It talks about, for by faith, the Old Testament saints believed that God would keep his promises, even though they died without seeing those promises fulfilled. Faith is basically trusting God to keep his promises, even if you don't see those promises fulfilled in your lifetime. But when Abraham trusted God, the first example of faith in the Bible, where the word faith is actually even used, Genesis 15:6, God's promising to take his barren wife and raise through his barren wife a mighty nation so they'd be more innumerable than the stars. And God told Abraham, look at the stars. If you can count them, then you'll be able to count your descendants. Abram looked at the stars and then believed God, and God credited to him as righteousness. I think when he looked at the stars, it all of a sudden dawned on him, oh, wait a minute. The guy who's talking to me right now made this vast universe. If he can make this vast universe, he could take my barren wife and give us a child and raise for us a mighty nation. So it's not blind, irrational faith. It's not Kierkegaardian faith, okay? It's Abrahamic faith. And so you read the whole Hebrews chapter 11. It's by faith, men and women of God in the Old Testament saints, trusted God to keep his promises despite persecution, despite circumstances that didn't go their way. But that's a rational faith. Now, Kierkegaard, he saw the world in like three stories. He said that first, you come to life and you're all caught up with yourself and pleasure and beauty. Now, this isn't like hedonistic pleasure necessarily. It might devolve into that. But some humans live on that realm where everything is, you know, I like this and all this appeals to me. And so it's just the realm of beauty. But eventually, as you look at the realm of beauty and taste and this and that, you start to realize you have a crisis. And at that crisis moment, you realize you long for something more, you thirst for something more, and all of a sudden, you take a leap of blind faith, an act of the will, totally without reason, and you take a leap of blind faith into the next story, which is not the realm of beauty, but now it's the realm of duty. And you realize there are such things as right and wrong. And so you start living on that level, and that's not satisfying. And eventually you reach a moment of crisis where that's not enough. And through a leap of blind faith, an act of the will totally apart from reason, you enter the next stage or the next story, which is the realm of religion. You've gone beyond the realm of beauty and the realm of duty. Instead of having a relationship with God's moral laws, now you have a personal relationship with the lawgiver. I think two things. I think we can credit Kierkegaard with saying Christianity is not just propositional truth, it's also personal experience and personal relationship. The will has to get involved. At the same time, Descartes, it's all propositional truth. Kierkegaard, it's all an act of the will. Aquinas had a good balance. Aquinas gets slammed all the time. People read Descartes into him. Aquinas said, look, belief that is propositional truth, head knowledge, belief that God exists. But belief in Jesus for salvation, that's an act of the will. So Aquinas had both. Once you know with your head the propositional truth, you still have to then enter into that personal relationship through an act of the will. And so there's a point where Aquinas sounds just like Kierkegaard. And a lot of people who superficially read him don't see that. But there's a point where he says it's an act of the will. The difference between him and Kierkegaard, belief that propositional truth is irrelevant. With Aquinas, it's very relevant. It forms the foundation, the basis for you then to make an act of the will and say, yes, Jesus, I want you to be my Savior. So Aquinas had a good balance. The other side of the spectrum, I think even Pascal, though he differed from Aquinas in a lot of areas, had a good balance. So what you end up with, you end up with three different groups here. You end up with the empiricist, and David Hume is going to finish the work of Immanuel Kant, or at least emphasize it. You end up with the empiricist saying, truth can only be found through the five senses, but in reality, we really can't know anything with certainty. And then, so it leads to a skepticism. Then you got the rationalists like Hegel, but because they reject God, they end up with rejecting absolute truth, so the rationalists become some type of irrationalist. And then you get the Soren Kierkegaard, the religious irrationalist, the religious existentialist. So you get different groups of people, but this is all leading the church in all different directions apart from biblical Christianity. This is going to affect Jesus studies, the search for the historical Jesus. Why did we even need to start to search for the historical Jesus? He's right there in the Bible. All the evidence is there. National Geographic. They have scholars that work for them. They should know what the word early means. Yet apparently it means two different things for them. When they say, well, the Gospel of Mark, we date that at about 67 to 70 A.D., so that's very late. Well, number one, I would date Mark's Gospel much earlier than that. But even 67 to 70 A.D., that's within one generation of Jesus' death. You would think they would call that early. But instead they say that's very late. You know, all 40 years have gone by. The Gospel of Judas gets found. They agree that it was probably written between 160 and 180 AD, the original, and they call it, that's extremely early. The search for the historical Jesus was all based upon either Kierkegaardian thought, where the Bible really doesn't really make truth claims, it's all about subjective beliefs, or Immanuel Kant's claims that we can't really prove God's existence, throw out pure reason, just settle for practical reason. So these ideas are becoming the spirit of the age, and all of a sudden man is using his reason to argue against God. And in the end, if God is dead, then truth is dead, morality is dead, meaning in life is dead, and reason is dead. And eventually you end up with man is dead. We'll talk about that more when we get to Friedrich Nietzsche, but we'll probably save him for next week. We just talk about David Hume. David Hume denied the existence of innate ideas. He was an empiricist, so he came into life a blank slate, like Aquinas taught. He was an empiricist. Truth pretty much is only found through the five senses. And because of that, he became a skeptic. We couldn't prove things like the principle of causality with certainty. All the cosmological arguments, all the arguments for God's existence, it presupposes some type of effects have causes. But you can't prove cause and effect through the five senses. That's something we bring with us. That's one of the categories that we bring with us, like Kant said. But we can't prove those categories through reason. We just come with them. Now, if we all have the same categories in our mind, then I think we ought to say, okay, we don't come into life blank slates, like Aquinas said. And God probably put those categories in our mind because they do put us in touch with the world in which we live. But instead they said we can't prove it through reason, so we have no way of knowing if what we think is true really is true. And so David Hume, he lived from 1711 to 1776, said we can only know things with a high degree of probability. That's the best that we can accept. Now David Hume and miracles, let me bring up the Jewish philosopher Benedict Spinoza. Spinoza was a rationalist, find truth through reason alone. He was an ultra-rationalist. Hume he's an empiricist. We really could only find truth through the five senses unless it's something that's true by definition. This later on became known as the verification principle, the 20th century logical positivist. We'll talk about that later on in this course. Spinoza, with his view of reason, is at a point where the laws of nature, we're finding so many natural causes. So Spinoza said the laws of nature flow naturally from God, and if there were a miracle, then that would be God correcting a law of nature, or doing something better than a law of nature. It would prove that there's some kind of imperfection in the perfect being. We know God is perfect, so therefore miracles are impossible. So Spinoza argued that miracles are impossible. Everything God does, he does because he has to do it. He does it of necessity. And the laws of nature necessarily flow from him. There couldn't be another way of doing it. So miracles are rationally impossible. Hume would never say they're rationally impossible because he doesn't even really trust reason so much as he trusts the world of the senses. So Hume says that miracles are highly improbable. The way he argues is this. David Hume says the wise man only accepts the most probable option. If one of my students comes to me and says, my dog ate my homework, I'm probably not going to believe it. I'm probably going to say, no, it's more probable that you just didn't do it. Okay? The wise man only accepts the most probable option. The laws of nature have a high degree of probability. Look at the millions upon millions of eyewitness testimony of the way things naturally occur. But miracles, he wouldn't really say miracles violate the laws of nature, but he would say miracles are exceptions to the law of nature. They're highly improbable. Therefore, the wise man is going to always reject miracles because he's going to accept what is most probable. No. In fact, he says what would have to take place for him to accept the testimony of the apostles, and he gives all these different criteria that basically we reject all of ancient history. We reject the existence of Napoleon Bonaparte based on that, because you don't get that kind of evidence for anything. But if you have sincere eyewitnesses who are willing to die for their beliefs, then that tells us we need to look at those claims. Now Muslims are sincere enough to fly planes, radical Muslims, and blow up buildings and kill themselves in the process, but that shows us that they sincerely believe Muhammad was a prophet. Big deal. I disagree. I think they're sincerely wrong. But with the apostles, it's much tougher. You have to prove how they can be willing to die for and sincerely believe that Jesus bodily rose from the dead and appeared to them on numerous occasions. It's easy to explain how the Muslims could have been deceived and Muhammad was just plain wrong. He was a false prophet. It's not easy to explain how the apostles could be mistaken to think Jesus was alive in their presence and they were touching his wounds and he was eating food in their midst. And then they were willing to die for it? I mean, don't you think that as Ignatius, well, Ignatius wasn't an eyewitness, but as the Apostle Peter is about to be crucified upside down, don't you think he would think, am I really sure? That, and in 2 Peter, it's exactly what you see him saying, is that we know that we didn't follow clearly devised myths. We were there on a mountaintop with him, the Transfiguration. We heard the voice from heaven. This stuff is for real. And the time of my departure has come. He knew he was going to die, but it was worth dying for because he knew Jesus had conquered death for himself and would be able to conquer death for him as well. Now let me say this. Lots and lots of atheists will act like David Hume was an atheist and he's their hero. David Hume favored the teleological argument. Just read his Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. He basically said the teleological argument, it doesn't necessarily prove only one designer. Maybe even the designer or the designers could still be evil, or they could be limited, they could be finite. But in the end, he said it's more probable that the teleological argument works than that it doesn't work. So even David Hume, he was not an atheist, he was a deist. He rejected miracles, but he still believed in the existence of God. And because the laws of nature were viewed as this big, the universe viewed as a big clock, he believed in the clockmaker. And so the teleological argument made sense for him. So many, if atheists listed their favorite 50 philosophers, probably throughout the centuries, 45, 46 of them would not be atheists. They'd believe in the existence of some type of God. So in other words, when you, now the 20th century was an aberration. That aberration is over, where atheism reigned in the universities and the philosophy lecture halls. When you look at philosophy across the spectrum, you get pretty much the same percentage that you get with garbage men and mailmen and just regular hardworking people. Probably 9 out of 10 or higher believe that some type of God exists.